Donald Trump is not president yet, but his words already carry a lot of weight. He criticized the cost of Lockheed Martin's F-35 fighter jet late last month, and shares in that company tumbled. Shares in Boeing also fell in early December after Trump called the price of the new Air Force One out of control. And pharmaceutical stocks took a dive after Trump told Time magazine that he doesn't like what's happened with drug prices. It is the power of the bully pulpit, and Trump apparently isn't afraid to use it. Matthew Slaughter is dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. He also served on the Council of Economic Advisors in the George W. Bush administration. He did not vote for Donald Trump. He joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Matt, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure to be here.
How would you describe how much power the president has to move markets?
The power is substantial. The president is the commander in chief, and is in some broad sense the chief economic policy leader of the United States. When he or she speaks, if it's relevant to a particular company or a particular industry, markets historically can move and have moved quite a bit.
Have we seen interesting examples of this happening in the past?
We have. Oftentimes, when we think about economic policy, around times of economic turmoil, or think especially of the financial crisis the United States experienced in late 2008 and early 2009, it was vital during that time that President Bush and his key advisors, such as Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, they needed to choose their words very prudently and carefully to try to not aggravate the panic that was spreading in financial markets.
Okay, well, hold that thought because we're going to get there. But let's stay with Donald Trump for just a minute, because you have to assume that Donald Trump knows exactly what he's doing. He comes from a business background. What did you think when you heard him making these comments about Boeing and the airplane being too expensive, or about drug prices, and then saw markets moving?
I was surprised. I think he understands fully well, as an experienced business leader, the power of the words that government leaders have, and importantly, the way that business leaders need to allocate their time. He knew full well, I believe, that when he tweeted about Boeing or about drug company prices, how that would change the behavior of the CEOs and key leaders in these companies and make them have to focus substantial time and energy on addressing the immediate concerns that the president-elect was voicing and the broader policy issues he was raising.
There is this idea that presidents shouldn't pick winners and losers. I often hear that phrase, that exact phrase, when we're talking about this. Where did that come from?
I think it comes from a long history where a lot of academic research and policy research shows that government leaders, as earnest as their desire might be to create good jobs at good wages, when they get into the business of trying to identify viable and profitable business opportunities for particular companies or industries, government leaders are no better and in many ways far worse than the private sector trying to do the same thing with stock picks and so forth. Mm-hmm. So government's trying to pick successful companies and industries has a track record in the United States and many other countries of not doing all that well.
Okay, well, here is an interesting example of that. Trump, as we know, made a big deal out of the deal that he made with the Carrier air conditioning plant in Indianapolis that kept about 800 jobs from going to Mexico. We should probably point out that some jobs did end up leaving for Mexico, or will end up leaving for Mexico. But here's Trump promising more deals like that with other companies at a speech in December.
We're going to have a lot of phone calls made to companies when they say they're thinking about leaving this country, because they're not leaving this country. They're not going to leave this country. And the workers are going to keep their jobs. And they can leave from state to state. And they can negotiate good deals with the different states and all of that. But leaving the country is going to be very, very difficult. So
look, this is exactly why people voted for Donald Trump. It's a part of his appeal. And he would probably make the argument that if browbeating a company not to move to Mexico can save jobs in America, that it's worth doing. And, I mean, do you at all think that it is worth reexamining the way that the presidents speak to individual companies?
I worry in a couple of ways about what President-elect Trump's words were there. I think the verb leave is a very important one to focus on for a moment. The academic research shows very clearly that when U.S.-based companies expand abroad their operations and their foreign affiliates by hiring more people and investing more in the capital stock in these foreign affiliates, that tends to complement, not substitute for, their U.S. business operations. For example, oftentimes they're building up their sales force so they can expand revenues in these foreign markets in a way that creates more jobs back here in research and development and marketing. So the verb leave has a whole set of assumptions behind it that actually a lot of the evidence doesn't support. I think the second and broader point is Our American labor market is incredibly dynamic. Every hour that America is open for business, over 30,000 U.S. jobs are destroyed in that hour. It's about 5 million gross worker firm separations each month in the U.S. economy. So the president's time is very valuable. The idea that the president can somehow monitor and evaluate the many business decisions behind all that dynamism in the labor market, I think is pretty off base.
You mentioned a time when it was very important for presidents not to single out certain companies and to really watch their language and the way they spoke about the economy. You mentioned the financial crisis. So let's listen to George W. Bush in September of 2008 at the peak of that crisis, speaking after the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers.
In the short run, adjustments in the financial markets can be painful, both for the people concerned about their investments and for the employees of the affected firms. In the long run, I'm confident that our capital markets are flexible and resilient and can deal with these adjustments.
You know, a lot of people will blame George W. Bush and deregulation for helping create the financial crisis, but in this particular case, how did he do?
I give him high marks there. One important thing for us to remember, go back at the to September 2008, Lehman Brothers files for bankruptcy, AIG almost files for bankruptcy, save for government support. And this fear was gripping the financial system and the broader world economy, because suddenly all sorts of lenders to banks and all sorts of business leaders had no confidence about which bank might be in trouble. I mean, it was literally like in the movie Mary Poppins when Michael Banks was running through the bank and triggering a bank run. So what the president did in that particular instance that was very important was not single out any particular company or any particular part of markets to allow regulators and the markets themselves to figure out the information they needed to stabilize things.
Here's President Obama in his first State of the Union speech in 2009. He's talking about a plan that would bail out a number of big banks. And this is just a couple of months after George W. Bush spoke.
Now, I understand that on any given day, Wall Street may be more comforted by an approach that gives bank bailouts with no strings attached and that holds nobody accountable for their reckless decisions. But such an approach won't solve the problem. And our goal is to quicken the day when we restart lending to the American people and American business and end this crisis once and for all. And I intend to hold these banks fully accountable for the assistance they receive, and this time, they will have to clearly demonstrate how taxpayer dollars result in more lending for the American taxpayer.
So the president here did not single out an individual bank, but he does say, I intend to hold these banks fully accountable. He singles out an industry. How does that compare to, you know, what we've seen Donald Trump already do?
Great question. And I think the important difference was time had passed. So that was President Obama's first State of the Union address early in 2009. 4 or 5 months had passed relative to the real peak of the panic in September of 2008. The real U.S. economy was suffering. We knew at that point we were losing on net several hundred thousand jobs a month. And yet there was an understanding that the Federal Reserve and other central banks had stemmed the worst of the panic. And so leaders were then to start to be able to talk about a broader set of issues, such as how did we get into this situation in the financial system and who's accountable for it?
Well, look, before I let you go, I remember before the election in November, some economists were saying that if Donald Trump were elected, it would not be good for markets because, as we hear often, markets like certainty. But stocks are up since November 8th. Is there a chance that we have all of this backwards?
There's a chance. It's always difficult to understand movements in stock prices and other asset prices. The increase in U.S. stock prices in recent months is consistent with markets focusing on a hope and expectation that President Trump and the new Congress will implement corporate tax reform, will cut personal tax rates, might try to alleviate some of the regulatory burden companies think that they are under, all of which might on net stimulate hiring and spending by companies that would be good for the broader economic performance in America and good for stock prices. We shall see how that plays out.
Yeah, good for the broader economy, probably the key point there. Matt Slaughter, dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, also served on the Council of Economic Advisors from 2005 to 2007 in the George W. Bush administration. Matt, thanks for your time.
Peter, a pleasure. Thanks very much.